softly so that Mother won't hear. Dama, Dama, strong back, I presume.
Just Tamaya, she says automatically.
He inclines his head gracefully and extends a hand to her. So noted. Will you join us then, Tamaya? Tamaya doesn't move, and he does not grab her. He just stays where he is, patient as stone, hand offering and not taking. 10 breaths pass, 20. Tamaya knows she'll have to go with him, but she likes that he makes it feel like a choice. So at last, she takes his hand and lets him pull her up. He keeps her hand while she dusts off as much of the straw as she can, and then he tugs her closer just a little.
One moment.
Huh?
But the child buyer's other hand is already behind her head, pressing 2 fingers into the base of her skull so quickly and deftly that she doesn't startle. He shuts his eyes for a moment, shivers minutely, and then exhales, letting her go.
Duty first,
he says cryptically. She touches the back of her head, confused, and still feeling the lingering sensation of his fingers' pressure.
Now let's head downstairs.
What did you do?
Just a little ritual of sorts. Something that will make it easier to find you, should you ever become lost.
She cannot imagine what this means.
Come now. I need to tell your mother you'll be leaving with me.
So it really is true. Tamaya bites her lip, and when the man turns to head back to the ladder, she follows a pace or two behind.
Well, that's that, says the child buyer as they reach Mother on the ground floor.
Mother sighs at the sight of her, perhaps in exasperation.
If you could assemble a package for her, 1 or 2 changes of clothing, any travel food you can provide, a coat, we'll be on our way.
Mother draws up in surprise. We gave away her coat.
Gave it away? In winter?
He speaks mildly, but Mother looks abruptly uncomfortable.
She's got a cousin who needed it. We don't all have wardrobes full of fancy clothes to spare, and...
Here Mother hesitates, glancing at Tamaya. Tamaya just looks away. She doesn't want to see if Mother looks sorry for giving away the coat. She especially doesn't want to see if Mother's not sorry.
And you've heard that Aura jeans don't feel cold the way others do, says the man with a weary sigh. That's a myth. I assume you've seen your daughter take cold before.
Oh, Mother looks flustered. Yes, but I thought...
That Tamaya might have been faking it. That was what she'd said to Tamaya that first day after she got home from creche and while they were setting her up in the barn. Mother had raged, her face streaked with tears, while Father just sat there silent and white-lipped.
Tamaya had hidden it from them, Mother said. Hidden everything, pretended to be a child when she was really a monster. That was what monsters did. She had always known there was something wrong with Tamaya. She'd always been such a little liar.
The man shakes his head.
Nevertheless, she will need some protection against the cold. It will grow warmer as we approach the equatorials, but we'll be weeks on the road getting there.
Mother's jaw flexes.
So you're really taking her to Eumenes, then?
Of course, I...
The man stares at her.
Ah.
He glances at Tamaya. They both look at Tamaya, their gazes like an itch. She squirms.
So even thinking I was coming to kill your daughter, you had the calm headman summon me.
Mother tenses. Don't! It wasn't... I didn't...
At her sides, her hands flex. Then she bows her head as if she is ashamed, which Tamaya knows is a lie. Mother isn't ashamed of anything she's done. If she was, why would she do it?
Ordinary people can't take care of children like her, says Mother very softly. Her eyes dart to Demaya's once and away, fast.
She almost killed a boy at school. We've got another child and neighbors and...
Abruptly, she squares her shoulders, lifting her chin.
And it's any citizen's duty, isn't it?
True. True, all of it. Your sacrifice will make the world better for all.
The words are a stock phrase. Praise. The tone is uniquely not. Demaya looks at the man again, confused now because child buyers don't kill children. That would defeat the point. And what's this about the Equatorials? Those lands are far, far to the south. The child buyer glances at Demaya and somehow understands that she does not understand. His face softens, which should be impossible with those frightening eyes of his.
To Eumenes, the man says to Mother.
To Demaya.
Yes. She's young enough, so I'm taking her to the fulcrum. There she will be trained to use her curse. Her sacrifice, too, will make the world better.
Demaya stares back at him, realizing just how wrong she's been. Mother has not sold Demaya. She and Father have given Demaya away. And Mother does not hate her. Actually, she fears Demaya. Is there a difference? Maybe. Demaya doesn't know how to feel in response to these revelations. And the man? The man is not a child buyer at all. He's...
You're a guardian?
She asks, even though by now she knows. He smiles again. She did not think guardians were like this. In her head, they are tall, cold-faced, bristling with weapons and secret knowledge. He's tall, at least.
I am,
he says, and takes her hand. He likes to touch people a lot, she thinks.
I'm your guardian.
Mother sighs. I can give you a blanket for her.
That will do, thank you.
And then the man falls silent, waiting. After a few breaths of this, Mother realizes he's waiting for her to go fetch it. She nods jerkily, then leaves, her back stiff the whole way out of the barn. So then the man and Demaya are alone.
Here,
he says, reaching up to his shoulders. He's wearing something that must be a uniform. Blocky shoulders and long, stiff lines of sleeve and pant leg. Burgundy cloth that looks sturdy but scratchy. Like Ma's quilt. It has a short cape, more decorative than useful. But he pulls it off and wraps it around Demaya. It's long enough to be a dress on her, and warm from his body. Thank you, she says. Who are you?
My name is Shafa. Guardian Warrant.
She's never heard of a place called Warrant, but it must exist, because what good is a calm name otherwise? Guardian is a use name?
It is for guardians.
He drawls this, and her cheeks grow warm with embarrassment.
We aren't much use to any calm, after all, in the ordinary course of things.
Demaya frowns in confusion. What, so they'll kick you out when a season comes? But guardians are many things she knows from the stories. Great warriors and hunters and sometimes, often, assassins. Calms need such people when hard times come. Shafa shrugs, moving away to sit on a bale of old hay. There's another bale behind Demaya, but she keeps standing because she likes being on the same level with him. Even sitting, he's taller. But at least not by so much.
The Orogenes of the Fulcrum serve the world, he says. You will have no use name from here forth, because your usefulness lies in what you are, not merely some familial aptitude. From birth, an Orogen child can stop a shake. Even without training, you are Orogen. Within a calm or without one, you are Orogen. With training, however, and with the guidance of other skilled Orogens at the Fulcrum, You can be useful not merely to a single calm, but all the stillness.
He spreads his hands.
As a guardian via the origins in my care, I've taken on a similar purpose, with a similar breath. Therefore, it's fitting that I share my charge's possible fate.
Tamaya is so curious, so full of questions, that she doesn't know which to ask first. Do you have...
She stumbles over the concept, the words, the acceptance of herself.
Others? Like me? I...
And she runs out of words. Shafa laughs, as if he senses her eagerness, and it pleases him.
I am guardian to 6 right now, he says,
inclining his head to let Demaya know that this is the right way to say it, to think it.
Including you.
And you brought them all to Humanis? You found them like this, like me?
Not exactly. Some were given into my care, born within the fulcrum, or inherited from other guardians. Some I've found since being assigned to ride circuit in this part of the Nomitlats.
He spreads his hands.
When your parents reported their orogenic child to Balela's headman, he telegraphed word to Brevard, which sent it to Gedo, which sent it to Eumenes, and they in turn telegraphed word to me.
He sighs.
It's only luck that I checked in at the node station near Brevard the day after the message arrived. Otherwise, I wouldn't have seen it for another 2 weeks.
Devaya knows Brevard, though Eumenes is only legend to her, and the rest of the places Shafa has mentioned are just words in a creche textbook. Brevard is the town closest to Palela, and it's much bigger. It's where Father and Chaga go to sell farm shares at the beginning of every growing season. Then she registers his words. 2 more weeks in this barn, freezing and pooping in a corner. She's glad he got the message in Brevard, too.
You're very lucky, he says,
perhaps reading her expression. His own has grown sober.
Not all parents do the right thing. Sometimes they don't keep their child isolated, as the fulcrum and we guardians recommend. Sometimes they do, but we get the message too late. And by the time a guardian arrives, a mob has carried the child off and beaten her to death. Don't think unkindly of your parents, Dama. You're alive and well, and that is no small thing.
Demaya squirms a little, unwilling to accept this. He sighs.
And sometimes, he continues, the parents of an origin will try to hide the child, to keep her untrained and without a guardian. That always goes badly.
This is the thing that's been in her mind for the past 2 weeks, ever since that day at school. If her parents loved her, they would not have locked her in the barn. They would not have called this man. Mother would not have said those terrible things. Why can't they? She blurts before she realizes he has said this on purpose. To see if why can't they just hide me and keep me here is something she's been thinking. And now he knows the truth. Demaya's hands clench on the cape where she's holding it closed around herself, but Shafa merely nods.
First, because they have another child, and anyone caught harboring an unregistered origin is ejected from their com as a minimum punishment.
Demaya knows this, though she resents the knowledge. Parents who cared about her would risk, wouldn't they?
Your parents could not have wanted to lose their home, their livelihood, and custody of both their children. They chose to keep something, rather than lose everything. But the greatest danger lies in what you are, Dama. You can no more hide that than you can the fact that you are female, or your clever young mind.
She blushes, unsure if this is praise. He smiles, so she knows it is. He continues,
Every time the earth moves, you will hear its call. In every moment of danger, you will reach instinctively for the nearest source of warmth and movement. The ability to do this is to you, as fists are to a strong man. When a threat is imminent, of course you do what you must to protect yourself. And when you do, people will die.
Demaya flinches. Shafa smiles again, as kindly as always. And then Demaya thinks about that day. It was after lunch in the play yard. She had eaten her bean roll while sitting by the pond with Limi and Shantari, as she usually did while the other children played or threw food at each other. Some of the other kids were huddled in a corner of the yard, scratching the dirt and muttering to each other. They had a geometry test that afternoon. And then Zab had come over to the three of them, though he'd looked at Demaya in particular as he said, "Let me cheat off you." Limi giggled. She thought Zab liked Demaya. Demaya didn't like him, though, because he was awful. Always picking on Demaya, calling her names, poking her until she yelled at him to stop and got in trouble with their teachers for doing it. So she said to Zab, "I'm not getting in trouble for you." He'd said, "You won't if you do it right. Just move your paper over." "No," she'd said again. "I'm not going to do it right. I'm not going to do it at all. Go away." She turned back to Shantari, who'd been talking before Zab interrupted. Next thing Demaya knew, she was on the ground. Zab had shoved her off the rock using both hands. She tumbled head over heels, literally, landing on her back. Later, she'd had 2 weeks in the barn to think about it. She would recall the look of shock on his face, as if he hadn't realized she would go over so easily. But at the time, all she had known was that she was on the ground, the muddy ground. Her whole back was cold and wet and foul. Everything smelled of fermenting bog and crushed grass. It was in her hair. And this was her best uniform, and Mother was going to be furious, and she was furious, and so she'd grabbed the air and... Demaya shivers. People will die. Shafa nods as if he has heard this thought.
"Your fire mountain glass, Dama."
He says this very softly.
"You are a gift of the earth. But Father Earth hates us, never forget. And his gifts are neither free nor safe. If we pick you up, hone you to sharpness, treat you with the care and respect you deserve, then you become valuable. But if we just leave you lying about, you'll cut to the bone the first person who blunders across you, or worse, you'll shatter and hurt many."
Demaya remembers the look on Zab's face. The air had gone cold for only an instant, billowing around her like a burst balloon. That was enough to make a crust of ice on the grass beneath her and to make the sweat drops go solid on Zab's skin. They stopped and jerked and stared at each other. She remembers his face.
"You almost killed me," she had seen there.
Shafa, watching her closely, has never stopped smiling.
"It isn't your fault," he says. "Most of what they say about Origins isn't true. There's nothing you did to be born like this, nothing your parents did. Don't be angry with them or with yourself."
She begins to cry because he's right. All of it, everything he says, it's right. She hates Mother for putting her in here. She's hated Father and Chaga for letting Mother do it. She hates herself for being born as she is and disappointing them all. And now, Shafa knows just how weak and terrible she is.
"Shh, shh, shh," he says, standing and coming over to her.
He kneels and takes her hands. She starts crying harder. But Shafa squeezes her hands, sharply, enough to hurt. And she starts and draws breath and blinks at him through the blur.
"You mustn't. Little one. Your mother will return soon. Never cry where they can see you."
What? He looks so sad for Demaya, as he reaches up and cups her cheek.
It isn't safe.
She has no idea what this means. Regardless, she stops. Once she's wiped her cheeks, he thumbs away a tear that she's missed, then nods after a quick inspection.
Your mother will probably be able to tell, but that should do for everyone else.
The barn door creaks and Mother is back, this time with Father in tow. Father's jaw is tight, and he doesn't look at Demaya, even though he hasn't seen her since Mother put her in the barn. Both of them focus on Shafa, who stands and moves a little in front of Demaya, nodding thanks as he accepts the folded blanket and twine-wrapped parcel that Mother gives him.
We've watered your horse, Father says stiffly. You want provender to carry?
No need, says Shafa. If we make good time, we should reach Brevard just after nightfall.
Father frowns.
A hard ride.
Yes, but in Brevard, no one from this village will get the fine idea to come seek us out along the road and make their farewells to Demaya in a ruder fashion.
It takes a moment for Demaya to understand, and then she realizes. People from Palela want to kill Demaya. But that's wrong, isn't it? They can't really, can they? She thinks of all the people she knows, the teachers from creche, the other children, the old ladies at the roadhouse who used to be friends with Ma before she died.
Father thinks this too. She can see that in his face.
And he frowns and opens his mouth to say what she's thinking. They wouldn't do something like that.
But he stops before the words leave his mouth. He glances at Demaya once, and with his face full of anguish, before remembering to look away again.
Here you are, Shafa says to Demaya, holding out the blanket.
It's Ma's. She stares at it, then looks at Mother, but Mother won't look back. It isn't safe to cry. Even when she pulls off Shafa's cloak and he wraps the blanket around her instead, familiar, fusty, and scratchy and perfect, she keeps her face completely still. Shafa's eyes flick to hers. He nods just a little in approval. Then he takes her hand and leads her toward the barn door. Mother and Father follow, but they don't say anything. Demaya doesn't say anything. She does glance at the house, once, catching a glimpse of someone through a gap in the curtains before the curtains flick shut. Chaga, her big brother, who taught her how to read and how to ride a donkey and how to skip rocks on a pond. He doesn't even wave goodbye. But this is not because he hates her. She sees that now. Shafa lifts Demaya onto a horse bigger than any she's ever seen. A big glossy bay with a long neck, and then Shafa's in the saddle behind her, tucking the blanket around her legs and shoes so she won't chafe or get chilblains. And then they are away.
Don't look back, Shafa advises. It's easier that way.
So she doesn't. Later she will realize he was right about this, too. Much later, though, she will wish that she had done it anyway.
Obscured. The ice-white eyes, the ash-blow hair, the filtering nose, the sharpened teeth, the salt-split tongue. From Tablet 2, The Incomplete Truth, Verse 8. 3. You're on your way. You're still trying to decide who to be. The self you've been lately doesn't make sense anymore. That woman died with Uche. She's not useful, unobtrusive as she is, quiet as she is, ordinary as she is. Not when such extraordinary things have happened. But you still don't know where Nasun is buried, if Jija bothered to bury her. Until you've said farewell to your daughter, you have to remain the mother that she loved. So you decide not to wait for death to come. It is coming for you, perhaps not right now, but soon.
Even though the big shake from the north missed Terimo, everyone knows it should have hit. The Sesapine do not lie, or at least not with such jangling, nerve-wracking, mind-screaming strength. Everyone from newborns to addled elders sensed that one coming. And by now, with refugees wandering down the road from less fortunate towns and villages, refugees who are all heading southward, the folk of Terimo will have begun to hear stories. They will have noticed the sulfur on the wind. They will have looked up at the increasingly strange sky and seen the change there as an ill omen. It is. Perhaps the headman Rask has finally sent someone over to see about Sume, the town in the next valley over. Most Terimos have family there. The two towns have been trading goods and people for generations. Calm comes before all else, of course. But as long as nobody's starving, kin and race can mean something, too. Rask can still afford to be generous for now. Maybe. And once the scouts return and report the devastation that you know they'll find in Sume, and the survivors that you know they won't find, or at least not in any great number, denial will no longer be possible. That will leave only fear. Frightened people look for scapegoats. So you make yourself eat, this time carefully not thinking of other times and other meals with Jija and the kids. Uncontrollable tears would be better than uncontrollable vomiting, but hey, you can't choose your grief. Then, letting yourself quietly out through Lerna's garden door, you go back to your house. No one's around outside. They must all be at Rask's, waiting for news or duty assignments. In the house, one of the store caches hidden beneath the rugs holds the family's runny sack. You sit on the floor in the room where Uche was beaten to death, and there you sort through the sack, taking out anything you won't need. The set of worn, comfortable travel clothing for Nasun is too small. You and Jija put this pack together before Uche was born, and you've been neglectful in not refreshing it. A brick of dried fruit has molded over in fuzzy white. It might still be edible, but you're not desperate enough for that. Yet. The sack contains papers that prove you and Jija own your house, and other papers showing that you're current on your courtant taxes and were both registered Terimo Calm and Resistant Use Cast members. You leave this, your whole financial and legal existence for the past 10 years, in a little discarded pile with the moldy fruit. The wad of money in a rubber wallet, paper, since there's so much of it, will be irrelevant once people realize how bad things are. But until then, it's valuable. Good tinder once it's not. The obsidian skinning knife that Jija insisted upon, and which you're unlikely to ever use, you have better natural weapons, you keep. Trade goods. Or at least a visual worn-off. Jija's boots can also be traded, since they're in good condition. You'll never wear them again, because soon you will find him. And then you will end him. You pause. Revise that thought to something that better befits the woman you've chosen to be. Better. You will find him and ask him why he did what he did, how he could do it. And you will ask him, more importantly, where your daughter is. Repacking the runny sack, you then put it inside one of the crates Jija used for deliveries. No one will think twice of seeing you carry it around town, because until a few days ago you did so often, to help out Jija's ceramics and tool-napping business. Eventually it will occur to someone to wonder why you're filling delivery orders when the headman is probably on the brink of declaring seasonal law. But most people will not think of it at first, which is what matters. As you leave, you pass the spot on the floor where Uche lay for days. Lerna took the body and left the blanket. The blood splatters are not visible. Still, you do not look in that direction. Your house is one of several in this corner of town, nestled between the southern edge of the wall and the town Greenland. You picked the house back when you and Jija decided to buy it, because it's isolated on a narrow, tree-shrouded lane. It's a straight run across the green to the town center, which Jija always liked. That was something you and he always argued about. You didn't like being around other people more than necessary. While Jija was gregarious and restless, frustrated by silence. The surge of absolute grinding, head-pounding rage catches you by surprise. You have to stop in the doorway of your home, bracing your hand against the doorframe and sucking in deep breaths so that you don't start screaming, or perhaps stabbing someone, yourself, with that damn skinning knife. Or worse, making the temperature drop. Okay, you were wrong. Nausea isn't so bad as a response to grief, comparatively speaking. But you have no time for this, no strength for this, so you focus on other things. Any other things. The wood of the door sill beneath your hand. The air, which you notice more now that you're outside. The sulfur smell doesn't seem to be getting worse, at least for now, which is perhaps a good thing. You assess that there are no open earth vents nearby, which means this is coming from up north where the wound is, that great suppurating rip from coast to coast that you know is there, even though the travelers along the Imperial Road have only brought rumors of it so far. You hope the sulfur concentration doesn't get much worse, because if it does, people will start to retch and suffocate. And the next time it rains, the creek's fish will die and the soil will sour. Yes, better. After a moment, you're able to walk away from the house at last, your veneer of calm back firmly in place. Not many people are out and about. Rask must have finally declared an official lockdown. During lockdown, the comms gates are shut, and you guess by the people moving about near one of the wall watchtowers that Rask has taken the preemptive step of putting guards in place. That's not supposed to happen till a season is declared. Privately, you curse Rask's caution. Hopefully, he hasn't done anything else that will make it harder for you to slip away. The market is shut down, at least for the time being, so that no one will hoard goods or fix prices. A curfew starts at dusk, and all businesses that aren't crucial for the protection or supply of the town are required to close. Everyone knows how things are supposed to go. Everyone has assigned duties, but many of these are tasks that can be done indoors. Weaving storage baskets, drying and preserving all perishable food in the house, repurposing old clothing and tools. It's all imperially efficient and lore letter, following rules and procedures that are simultaneously meant to be practical and to keep a large group of anxious people busy, just in case. Still, as you walk the path around the green's edge, during lockdown no one walks on it, not because of any rule, but because such times remind them that the green is cropland to be, and not just a pretty patch of clover and wildflowers. You spy a few other Terimo denizens out and about. Strongbacks, mostly. One group is building the paddock and shed that will segregate a corner of the green for livestock. It's hard work, building something. And the people doing it are too engrossed in the task to pay much heed to a lone woman carrying a crate. A few faces you vaguely recognize as you walk, people you've seen before at the market or via Jija's business. You catch a few glances from them too, but these are fleeting. They know your face enough that you are not stranger. For now, they're too busy to remember that you may also be Raga's mother. Or to wonder from which parent your dead Raga child might have inherited his curse. In the town center, there are more people about. Here you blend in, walking at the same pace as everyone else, nodding if nodded too, trying to think about nothing so that your face falls into bored, disengaged lines. It's busy around the headman's office. Block captains and caste spokespeople coming in to report what lockdown duties have been completed before heading back out to organize more. Others mill about, clearly hoping for word on what's happened in Sumé and elsewhere. But even here, no one cares about you. And why should they? The air stinks of broken earth, and everything past a 20-mile radius has been shattered by a quake greater than any living person has ever known. People have more important matters to concern them. That can change quickly, though. You don't relax. Rask's office is actually a small house nestled between the stilted grain caches and the carriage works. As you stand on tiptoe to see above the crowd, you're unsurprised to see Oyamar, Rask's second, standing on its porch and talking with two men and a woman who are wearing more mortar and mud than clothing. Shoring up the well, probably. That's one of the things Stonelore advises in the event of a shake, and which Imperial lockdown procedure encourages, too. If Oyamar is here, then Rask is elsewhere, either working or, knowing Rask, sleeping after having worn himself out in the 3 days since the event. He won't be at home because people can find him too easily there. But because Lerna talks too much, you know where Rask hides when he doesn't want to be disturbed. Tarimo's library is an embarrassment. The only reason they have one is that some previous headwoman's husband's grandfather raised a stink and wrote letters to the Quartant governor, until finally the governor funded a library to shut him up. Few people have used it since the old man died. But although there are always motions to shut it down at the all-com meetings, those motions never get quite enough votes to proceed. So it lingers. A ratty old shack, not much bigger than the den of your house, packed nearly full with shelves of books and scrolls. A thin child could walk between the shelves without contorting. You are neither thin nor a child, so you have to slip in sideways and sort of crab walk. Bringing the crate is out of the question. You set it down just inside the door. But that doesn't matter, because there's no one here to peek inside it, except Rask, who's curled up on a tiny pallet at the back of the shack, where the shortest shelf leaves a space just wide enough for his body. As you finally manage to push your way between the stacks, Rask starts out of a snore and blinks up at you, already beginning to scowl at whoever has disturbed him. Then he thinks, because he's a level-headed fellow, and that's why Tarimo elected him. And you see in his face the moment when you go from being Jija's wife to Uche's mother to Raga's mother to, oh, Earth, Raga too. That's good. Makes things easier. I'm not going to hurt anyone, you say quickly, before he can recoil or scream or whatever he is tensed to do. And to your own surprise, at these words, Rask blinks and thinks again, and the panic recedes from his face. He sits up, leaning his back against a wooden wall, and regards you for a long, thoughtful moment. You didn't come here just to tell me that, I assume, he says. You lick your lips and try to hunker down in a crouch. It's awkward, because there's not much room. You have to brace your butt against a shelf, and your knees encroach more than you'd like on Rask's space. He half smiles at your obvious discomfort. Then his smile fades as he remembers what you are. And then he frowns to himself as if both reactions annoy him. You say, do you know where Jija might have gone? Rask's face twitches. He's old enough to be your father, just. But he's the least paternal man you've ever met. You've always wanted to sit down somewhere and have a beer with him, even though that doesn't fit the ordinary meek camouflage you've built around yourself. Most of the people in town think of him that way, despite the fact that as far as you know, he doesn't drink. The look that comes into his face in this moment, however, makes you think for the first time that he would make a good father if he ever had children. So that's it, he says. His voice is gravelly with sleep. He killed the kid, that's what people think, but Lerna said he wasn't sure. You nod. You couldn't say the word yes to Lerna either, Rask's eyes search your face.
And the kid was...
You nod again, and Rask sighs. He does not, you note, ask whether you are anything.
Nobody saw which way Jija went, he says, shifting to draw his knees up and rest one arm on them. People have been talking about the killing. Because it's easier than talking about...
He lifts and drops his hands in a helpless gesture.
Lots of gossip, I mean, and a lot of it's more mud than stone. Some people saw Jija load up your horse cart and go off with Nasun.
Your thoughts stutter.
With Nasun?
Yeah, with her. Why?
Then Rask understands.
Oh, shit. She's one, too.
You try not to start shaking. You do clench your fists in an effort to prevent this, and the earth far below you feels momentarily closer, the air immediately around you cooler, before you contain your desperation and joy and horror and fury. I didn't know she was alive, is all you say, after what feels like a very long moment.
Oh.
Rask blinks, and that compassionate look returns.
Well, yeah. She was when they left, anyway. Nobody knew anything was wrong or thought anything of it. Most people figured it was just a father trying to teach his firstborn the business. Or keep a bored child out of trouble, the usual. And that shit up north happened. And everybody forgot about it till Lerna said he'd found you and your boy.
He pauses here, jaw flexing once.
Never would have figured Jija for the type. He hit you?
You shake your head. Never. It might have been easier to bear somehow if Jija had been violent beforehand. Then you could have blamed yourself for poor judgment or complacency, and not just for the sin of reproducing. Rask takes a deep, slow breath.
Shit. Just... shit.
He shakes his head, rubs a hand over the gray fuzz of his hair. He's not a born gray, like Lerna and others with ash-blow hair. You remember when his hair was brown.
You going after him?
His gaze flickers away and back. It is not quite hope. But you understand what he is too tactful to say.
Please leave town as soon as possible.
You nod, happy to oblige. I need you to give me a gate pass.
Done.
He pauses.
You know you can't come back.
I know. You make yourself smile. I don't really want to.
Don't blame you.
He sighs. Then shifts again, uncomfortable.
My sister.
You didn't know Rask had a sister. Then you understand. What happened to her?
He shrugs. The usual. We lived in Sume then. Somebody realized what she was, told a bunch of other somebodies. And they came and took her in the night.
I don't remember much about it. I was only 6.
My folks moved here with me after that.
His mouth twitches, not really smiling.
So I never wanted kids myself.
You smile too. I didn't either. Jija had, though.
Rusting earth.
He closes his eyes for a moment, then abruptly gets to his feet. You do too, since otherwise your face will be entirely too close to his stained old trousers.
I'll walk you to the gate if you're going now.
This surprises you. I'm going now, but you don't have to. You're not sure this is a good idea, really. It might draw more attention than you want. But Rask shakes his head, his jaw set and grim.
I do. Come on.
Rask? He looks at you. And this time, you are the one who winces. This isn't about you anymore. The mob that took his sister from him wouldn't have dared to do so if he'd been a man at the time. Or maybe they'd just have killed him, too. He carries the crate as you walk down Seven Seasons, the town's main street, all the way up to main gate. You're twitchy, trying to look confident and relaxed, even though you feel anything but. It would not have been your choice to walk this route, through all these people. Rask draws all the attention at first, as people wave or call out to him or come over to ask him if there's any news. But then they notice you. People stop waving. They stop approaching and start, at a distance, in twos and threes, watching. And occasionally following. There's nothing to this except the usual small-town nosiness, at least on the surface. But you see these knots of people also whispering, and you feel them staring, and that sets all your nerves a-jangle in the worst way. Rask hails the gate guards as you approach. A dozen or so strongbacks who are probably miners and farmers under ordinary circumstances are there, just milling about in front of the gate with no real organization. Two are up in the crow's nests built atop the wall where they can overlook the gate. Two are standing near the gate's eye holes at ground level. The rest are just there, looking bored or talking or joking with one another. Rask probably chose them for their ability to intimidate, because all of them are sansed big and look like they can handle themselves even without the glass knives and crossbows they carry. The one who steps forward to greet Rask is actually the smallest of them, a man you know, though you don't remember his name. His children have been in your classes at the town creche. He remembers you, too, you see, when his eyes fix on you and narrow. Rask stops and sets the crate down, opening it and handing you the runny sack.
Kiara,
he says to the man you know,
everything okay here? Was till now,
Kara says, not taking his eyes off you. The way he's looking at you makes your skin tighten. A couple of the other strongbacks are watching too, glancing from Kara to Rask and back, ready to follow someone's lead. One woman is openly glaring at you, but the rest seem content to glance at you and away in quick slashes.
Good to hear, Rask says.
You see him frown a little, perhaps, as he reads the same signals you're picking up on.
Tell your people to open the gate for a minute, will you?
Kara doesn't take his eyes off you.
Think that's a good idea, Rask?
Rask scowls and steps sharply up to Kara, getting right in his face. He's not a big man, Rask. He's an innovator, not a strongback. Not that it really matters anymore. And right now, he doesn't need to be.
Yeah,
Rask says, his voice so low and tight that Kara focuses on him at last with a stiffening of surprise.
I do. Open the gate if you don't mind. If you're not too rusting busy.
You think of a line from Stone Lore, Structures verse 3. The body fades. A leader who lasts relies on more. Kara's jaw flexes, but after a moment he nods. You try to look absorbed in shrugging on the runny sack. The straps are loose. Jija was the last one to try it on. Kara and the other gate minders get moving, working on the system of pulleys that helps to winch the gate open. Most of Tarimo's wall is made of wood. It's not a wealthy calm with the resources to import good stone or hire the number of masons needed, although they're doing better than poorly managed calms or new calms that don't even have a wall yet. The gate, though, is stone, because a gate is the weakest point of every calm wall. They only need to open it a little for you. And after a few slow grinding moments and calls from those hauling to those spotting for approaching intruders, they stop. Rask turns to you, plainly uncomfortable.
Sorry about Jija, he says.
Not about Uche, but maybe that's for the best. You need to keep your head clear.
About all of it, shit. Hope you find the bastard.
You only shake your head. Your throat is tight. Tarimo has been your home for 10 years. You only started to think of it as such home around the time of Uche's birth, but that's more than you ever expected to do. You remember chasing Uche across the green after he first learned to run. You remember Jija helping Nasun build a kite and fly it badly. The kite's remnants are still in a tree somewhere on the eastern side of town. But it is not as hard to leave as you thought it would be. Not now, with your former neighbor's stairs sliding over your skin like rancid oil. Thanks, you mutter, meaning for it to cover many things, because Rask didn't have to help you. He's damaged himself by doing so. The gateminders respect him less now, and they'll talk. Soon everyone will know he's a Raga lover, which is dangerous. Headmen can't afford that kind of weakness when a season's coming on. But for the moment, what matters most to you is the moment of public decency, which is a kindness and an honor you never expected to receive. You aren't sure how to react to it. He nods, uncomfortable as well, and turns away as you start toward the gap in the gate. Perhaps he does not see Kara nod to another of the gateminders. Perhaps he does not see the latter woman quickly shoulder her weapon and orient it on you. Perhaps you will think later. Rask would have stopped the woman, or somehow prevented everything to come, if he had seen. You see her, though, mostly out of the periphery of your vision. Then everything happens too fast to think. And because you don't think, because you've been trying not to think, and this means you're out of the habit. Because thinking means you will remember that your family is dead, and everything that meant happiness is now a lie, and thinking of that will make you break and start screaming and screaming and screaming, and because once upon a time and in another life, you learned to respond to sudden threats in a very particular way. You reach for the air around you and pull and brace your feet against the earth beneath you and anchor and narrow. And when the woman fires the crossbow, the bolt blurs toward you. Just before the bolt hits, it bursts into a million glittering frozen flecks. Naughty, naughty, chides a voice in your head. The voice of your conscience, deep and male. You forgot this thought almost the instant it occurs. That voice is from another life. Life. You look at the woman who just tried to kill you. What the shit? Kara stares at you, as if stunned by your failure to fall down dead. He crouches, hands balled into fists, nearly jumping up and down in his agitation.
Shoot her again! Kill her! Shoot, Earth! Damn it! Before...
What the fuck are you doing?
Rask, finally noticing what's happening, turns back. It's too late. Down below your feet and everyone else's, a shake begins. It's hard to tell at first. There is no warning jangle of Sasuna, as there would be if the movement of the earth came from the earth. That's why people like these fear people like you. Because you're beyond sense and preparation. You're a surprise, like a sudden toothache, like a heart attack. The vibration of what you're doing rises fast to become a rumble of tension that can be perceived with ears and feet and skin, if not Sasapine. But by this point, it's too late. Kara frowns, looking at the ground beneath his feet. Crossbow woman pauses in the middle of loading another bolt. Eyes widening as she stares at the shivering string of her weapon. You stand surrounded by swirling flecks of snow and disintegrated crossbow bolt. Around your feet, there is a 2-foot circle of frost rhyming the packed earth. Your locks waft gently in the rising breeze.
You can't,
Rask whispers the words, his eyes widening at the look on your face. You don't know what you look like right now, but it must be bad. He shakes his head as if denial will stop this, taking a step back and then another.
Ersun!
You killed him, you say to Rask. This is not a rational thing. You mean you, plural, even though you're speaking to you specific. Rask didn't try to kill you, had nothing to do with Uche. But the attempt on your life has triggered something raw and furious and cold. You cowards. You
Animals who look at a child and see prey. Jija is the one to blame for Uche. Some part of you knows that. But Jija grew up here in Terimo. The kind of hate that can make a man murder his own son? It came from everyone around you. Rask inhales.
Esun.
And then the valley floor splits open. The initial jolt of this is violent enough to knock everyone standing to the ground and sway every house in Terimo. Then those houses judder and rattle as the jolt smooths into a steady, ongoing vibration. Saider's cart repair shop is the first to collapse, the old wooden frame of the building sliding sideways off its foundation. There are screams from inside, and one woman manages to run out before the door frame crumples inward. On the eastern edge of town, closest to the mountain ridges that frame the valley, a rock slide begins. A portion of the eastern calm wall and three houses are buried beneath a sudden grinding slurry of mud and trees and rocks. Far below the ground, where no one but you can detect, the clay walls of the underground aquifer that supplies the village wells are breached. The aquifer begins to drain. They will not realize for weeks that you killed the town in this moment. But they will remember when the wells run dry. Those who survive the next few moments will, anyhow. From your feet, the circle of frost and swirling snow begins to expand, rapidly. It catches Rask first. He tries to run as the edge of your torus rolls toward him, but he's simply too close. It catches him in mid-lunge, glazing his feet and solidifying his legs and eating its way up his spine until, in the span of a breath, he falls to the ground stone stiff, his flesh turning as gray as his hair. The next to be consumed by the circle is Kara, who's still screaming for someone to kill you. The shout dies in his throat as he falls, flesh frozen, the last of his warm breath hissing out through clenched teeth and frosting the ground as you steal the heat from it. You aren't just inflicting death on your fellow villagers, of course. A bird, perched on a nearby fence, falls over frozen too. The grass crisps, the ground grows hard, and the air hisses and howls as moisture and density is snatched from its substance. But no one has ever mourned earthworms. Fast. The air swirls briskly all down seven seasons now, making the trees rustle, and anyone nearby cry out in alarm as they realize what's happening. The ground hasn't stopped moving. You sway with the ground, but because you know its rhythms, it is easy for you to shift your balance with it. You do this without thinking, because there's only room left in you for one thought. These people killed Uche. Their hate, their fear, their unprovoked violence, they. He killed your son. Jija killed your son. People run out into the streets, screaming and wondering why there was no warning, and you kill any of them who are stupid or panicked enough to come near. Jija. They are Jija. The whole rusting town is Jija. Two things save the calm, however. Or at least most of it. The first is that most of the buildings don't collapse. Terimo might be too poor to build with stone, but most of its builders are ethical and well paid enough to use only techniques that stone lore recommends. The hanging frame, the center beam. Second, the fault line of the valley, which you're currently peeling apart with a thought, is actually a few miles to the west. Because of these things, most of Terimo will survive this. At least until the wells die. Because of these things, and because of the terrified, bouncing scream of a little boy, as his father runs out of a madly swaying building. You pivot toward the sound instantly, habitually, orienting on the source, with a mother's ears. The man clutches the boy with both arms. He doesn't even have a runny sack. The first and only thing he took the time to grab was his son. The boy looks nothing like Uche. But you stare as the child bounces and reaches back toward the house for something the man has left behind, favorite toy, the boy's mother.